just about every dancer that's participating in the dance, you know, singing has a drum, a smaller drum. We may have one or two of the bigger drums to fill in the background.
And the smaller drum is made of?
Yellow cedar and goatskin.
So the brown drum is made of the red cedar?
No, yellow cedar.
Oh, yellow cedar.
The big box drums are made of red cedar.
And then I was sort of curious about, you said your colors were red, black, and white.
Yeah.
Were there, what do they symbolize?
I don't know. I'm learning about my background culture. You know, it's just started, in the last 5 years. I had to have a death of my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the majority of the information that I know about was learned at my dad's spotlight in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the actual recovering of the Indian ways and the culture really didn't start maybe within the last generation or two. Primarily the last generation. Because when I went back there during my dad's talk, I didn't realize how much recovery there was. It was overwhelming. You get a real high density influx of information coming at you all from all sides and different people and trying to absorb and retain all this. That's how quickly it came to me. And so up to that point, all my life up to that point, was just bits and pieces. It really didn't have any meaning, until this came along, those bits and pieces that I acquired during my life and had a place to fit into it. A lot of it did, yeah.
Only for kayaking?
Yeah, for canoeing down there. We have these canoes, I think. And mainly big dugouts from whole trees. And they dug them out, and they were 30, 40, 50 feet long. A lot of people and material. All dug out made from a log that they just dug out. And the way they did it, they started out, they got the outside shape. And then they drilled holes, marker holes, all through the hull, just punctured it with holes. And they drilled in. And then they used that as a guide to have uniform thickness throughout the, punch these holes in the log after they formed the outside shape, finished shape. Then they punched holes in there at a certain depth and packed it with ashes, burnt wood and black, and packed it in there and held it. So when you dug the inside, you had a gauge now to know how deep you have to dig. As soon as you've seen that black, you stop, and this was maybe a foot or so apart throughout the whole canoe. And once the entire inside of the canoe is dug out to that depth, those gauge marks And they plugged up the hole. Very simple way to call.
We also talked about the families who live above Blackwood, that they have to do the for 3 meals a day throughout the long time. And sometimes it took 2 years to prepare for something like this. Everything was prepared way in advance.
We gathered all the foods, like the fish and the up here is the moose, back down south east is the deer. All the different kinds of fish and all the different processes they have to dry the mostly the dry fish and the salmon or the seaweed. They have to gather that and dry it and restore it. A long time ago we stored it in wood stove barrels for dry fish. And at the camp they have a whole bunch of these, maybe 20, 30 of these big wood stove barrels that are probably 3 feet tall and up off the ground. I know they're kind of sit and have to sit and flatten off the bottom with the steel bands holding it together. And they use those barrels for a lot of things, but primarily that's what they use it for when I was going to store the fish for them. They dry it in the summer. And they left them right in the smokehouse. I remember going out there every time we needed something, you know, needed some more fish. We'd go out there and because these camps, this particular camp that we had was only about a mile or two from the village. And we just get what we needed out there and get back to our house. Once a week or something like that. Or when it's here. We salted fish. We took the bellies of the fish, salted it, stacked them and put salt in the salt of the fish. And those were wood stove barrels, but it was a smaller version of the barrels that we found that high. And then we used to stick them underneath the house. And they kept the sheep for a long time. And then we canned a lot of stuff too, jarred a lot of stuff. Fish and the different fish that we had available to them. We had plums, gooseberries, blueberries, huckleberries, blackberries.
What was the last one?
Laughing berries. They look like a blueberry, but they're bigger, bigger, they're larger.
I've never heard of that.
Mm-hmm. So there's, and all these, see, these are, I don't know if that's the true, they're not the true name. I don't even know the Simpson name, this Simpson name for all these things. I don't remember. This is what we call it in Arizona. Then we had an area of different medications that came from the wild. It's a devil club. It was used a lot. Oregon grease was used a lot too. And I think I mentioned to you guys that it was what tripped in the infection that I developed in my youth as a child. And modern medicine couldn't do anything.
We'll just go ahead and get started. Then's going to be our discussion. Listen to this.
I'm Benjamin Young. I'm a sophomore here, and I'm here to interview Delbert Hayward. Thanks for joining us, Delbert. Today I wanted to talk about teenage years or preteen. Since the last interview, we went over the missionary school and how it was growing up with your dad, fishing. And I just wanted to know how it was when you were 13 to maybe 18. How life went then, or what you remember about your father and grandparents.
Okay, I lived, got through at Haney's house when I was 12. I went home for the summer when I was 12, and then I went back to Haney's for the school year, and came back again the following summer. 13 to remain home, and finished grade school in Ewing, Lakota, and each year that I came home, starting at 12, I fished with my dad. And I learned a lot about the fishing trade. And then, like I say, I watched my dad, and he showed me, and he did this with all my brothers and sisters. Because my mother passed away when she was in the 27th city. All our source of learning is from him, and our grandparents. All the technical stuff, like on the boats, the mending of the gear, the putting the gear together, and taking it apart, and knowing how the boat operates, and you can't handle the standpoint, and repair the hull, and doing that. Actually, the boat, how do you say, developed from that fishing, because of the association of the boats. You got to learn how to repair and maintain the boats. Some of those boats are 50 years old. Every spring, every fall, there was always maintenance going on the boats. You had to replank, you had to replace planks, decking, cabins, sterns, things like that. And my dad was probably one of the best boat builders in town during his young life, starting at 19. And he was I'll give you a little history of him. He was going to school, as was a lot of kids of his generation. Going outside, he went to school like Chamawa. I don't remember the names of the others. There's two or three others that a lot of them the last minute have gone to. He went to one of them. And was recalled back out of it because his dad got ill and he couldn't run the boat. So at 19, he was still in high school. Down the water for him. And when he got called back one summer, he never went back to school. And took over the boat. He was at that point in the did a lot of major overhaul on that boat because it was pretty sad shape. Completely rebuilt that boat and from the water line up. The planks, the deck, the stern, and the cabin, and everything. So he just stripped it down to the water line and pulled it back up. This one was 19. So thus began the... He had all the skills already, he's honing his skills. He's going on to perfecting, because he learned all his skills, from grade school, high school, in that area. And this is how I because of him, he took me through the same path of learning. To be a fisherman, you have to be a jack of all trades. You're not an expert in any one of them, you're just good at all of it. And normally, for you to become a captain, well, you have to have all these skills. And by the time I was 16, I felt like I was ready. And I was anxious about what I wanted to do. Following the footsteps of my dad. And I'd say all those skills came from him. When he built one boat from the keel up, you know, from his mind to the drawing board to the blueprint and everything, it came from him. He designed it up, and you know, just the way he knew it. He took a basic hull that was well liked at the time back then and modified it, you know, the way he wanted, customized it the way he wanted. And I watched the whole process and learned it. You know, right from when he got the idea, because he used to do it every morning before going to work. And I'd get up, you know, about the same time that I'm going to school, and I'd sit and watch him. And he maybe spend an hour, I'd get up early enough, maybe spend an hour before work to. Or design, brainstorming. But he did this for years. At the same time this is going on, he logged and cut all the lumber for that boat, and dried it and cured it, and stockpiled it. And maybe it was, took 5 years to do that. Because, you know, all that kind of material that he wanted to use wasn't available on markets, normal markets, lumber markets. And this is where I learned the values of the different types of lumber that we use down there, that, and the reason why we use the yellow cedar as a primary lumber for planking, because it has a natural tendency to fight off all the, you know, the barnacles and the worms that get into the wood. You know, like it'll withstand all that. And you like to use fur, which we do use quite a bit of on those boats. More readily available than the yellow cedar. A lot of boats are built out of, but you have to put up with the annual maintenance on a higher level than you would with a boat that was built out of yellow cedar. And you have to replace tanks on a yellow cedar boat every 5 years, where with the fir lumber, it's every year. And same way with the red cedar. Now like we make our own shingles for the smokehouses and our camp. Living quarters was all made out of red cedar because it was light and easy. And when you split it, it split straight. Very nice for making shingles. We made these big, long shingles for red cedar. And that was quite available down there, even right on the drifter that was there on the beaches. A lot of these red cedar. There was all other types of drifter that was more readily available and lent itself readily to the building of a lot of our campsites. Let's see, I learned all this. I can remember a lot of things as far back as 5 years old. I learned how to community met when I was five. When I got to Jane's house, I built a net up there. 20-30 foot net, and I was probably 8 or 9, maybe 10 years old. And I made it about 20 feet long, about 6-8 feet deep. And used rocks for the lead line, and used cut pieces of driftwood and 2x4s and that for the cork, you know, so the floats that are to hold the net up above the water. And I caught a fish with it. Strange, and I still remember it. You know what halibut looked like? Mm-hmm. This had that basic shape, but it was, you know, and the head and the eyes are on top like a halibut. But for some reason it was narrower, really narrow and long. Never seen, from that point on, I've never seen a fish like that in all the years I fished. And it had you know what flounder, if you know what a flounder is, it's very similar to a halibut. It had that texture, kind of skin, and kind of rough. It had barbs on it too, you know. And so I never seen it in that. And it scared me. And then went to high school in Sheldon Jackson, Sutton, and was run by the Presbyterian Church for the Mass Commission. And the Haynes House was run by the same church for the Mass Commission. So I spent my entire growing up years in the Christian environment. It had a big influence on me, most of it negative. To me, in my young mind, there's too much conflict between what I perceived as real and unreal, spiritual, and both the right and wrong of the godly and the devil, you know, aspect of it. There was just too much conflict in my mind. I couldn't, for some reason, I couldn't say I'll accept this on faith. Mindset stayed with me all my life. I went through the process of joining the church and all that, you know, and learned the catechism and whatever's required of me to learn the Presbyterian Church. I couldn't say to myself, I said it to everybody else, and I said it to the church. It made me think I was lying. Murmuring to myself that people are sensitive. And that fact alone made me want to seek the truth. And that had a profound effect on me for my entire life. I struggled with it till I was 40, 45. So I want to believe it. There's a lot of good in religion, but also some bad things. There's no two religions in the same Christian religion. You know, how can they, you know, in my mind, right earlier, I said, how can a Catholic and a Presbyterian and a Methodist use this one Bible written word, almost word for word, the same. But probably, there must have been in my when I kind of put this all together. I was just thinking, well, how can they all agree to use this one Bible to agree differently about it? Yet it's the same body. So there must have been disagreements about it and how we develop the Christianity that we have today is all broken up like this in all these other different churches. And when I read the life of Father Duncan, and this to me opened up another bucket of worms, and it directly affected about my people. And there was a lot of good that he did in bringing us into the industrial age, way ahead of anybody else, you know, the native people, running water, electricity, and all the amenities that we have, pretty much like we have today in any place in the modern world. We had that 50 to 75 years before the people in the interior or any place else. And this is what he brought. He wanted us to become part of the modern culture. And in doing so, he wiped out our native culture. And this first time it was upsetting to me. Because I went through my entire life without knowing that I was a symptom or without a cultural background. And now the younger people, say two generations under me, have learned and have brought back the culture. Because see, all the time that they were trying to take it away from us and convert us into the modern culture, it brought shame about my thinking about it. And our generation's thinking, my parents and grandparents' generation thinking of, we were, you know, shame of our culture. And so nothing was really done about it. It just kind of sat in the background, festered, and we never discussed it. And many people didn't want to talk about it. And it carried on from my grandparents, my parents, and my generation. It stayed there in the background. If you look at the modern generation now, of any of our cultures, the majority of the young people today don't really fully understand their own culture. I would say that's probably true here in this room. And it's, you know, because of the dominant culture that's the modern culture. And it's just pushing away all of this. As it advances into the, as it advances through the years. And that's what it does. I mean, it's just that we're not the stone culture anymore, like it used to be, 400 years ago. But that's historically, you know, I start studying history, that's what happens. You know, the Roman times and the Spanish times, the English, and look at all the rising of power and they fall off. The next one takes over and they fall off. You know, on the average, they last 200-300 years. You know, turn back with, you know, Romans and Greeks and Egyptians, and you look at all of them, you know. And this is just that pattern that happens. Just our turn, the United States turn, dominating. world power, but they're weakening now. China's rising up. They used to be powerful at one time, but fell off and they took over now. Now they're on the upward swing economically. Technically, every rich day. And the U.S. is crumbling on them. But you see, all of these things that I grew up with and learned and helped me understand all of these things, going through the modern educational process and finally, within, say, when I turned 60, you know, when I started going back and paying attention to my, it's about the time I retired, started paying attention to my, trying to find out where my culture was. Because I didn't understand it all. I knew when we came from Canada, that's about it. But the Simpsons come back quite, they had a longer path to return than most of the other native cultures. Father Duncan was successful in wiping our culture out, Simpson culture. And he brought those converted people over to the monastery. But like I say, when you look at it overall, it was a good thing. We still have to take our place in this modern culture. It's there for the taking for us to step up to it. We need the people. It's not a subject, I think. But it's something I'm trying to point out to you. When I look back at you guys, your generation, and what I saw happening in my lifetime, I'm trying to show you through my mind's eye what happened. And this is something you're going to have to learn to understand. You're going to have to, you're right now buried in learning, being educated, in raising families. All these distractions. In spite of it all, you're going to have to learn all this, what this all means, how it affects the living and flowing of the economic system. It's all actually basically understanding human nature. Because it's all driven by man. And the economic system. It's just like one big person. It's all these millions and millions of people intervening that have an effect on the cause. Questions?
Okay. Is there any last questions that anybody would like to ask?
So Father Duncan was Presbyterian?
Pardon?
Father Duncan was Catholic? Or
no, he was with the Church of England.
Oh.
He's a missionary for that church. He came to British Columbia, where our people originally came from. It was back. They moved over to Alaska in 1886, I believe it was. That's not any longer.
Mm-hmm. And this was Presbyterian?
No.
That's different. Okay, sorry.
There's two churches back home.
Okay.
It was just two when I was young boy. He was a Presbyterian church and came later. The Church of England was the only church in the new building.
Does this church remain?
They're both area, and there are more than others now. All different look about. I'm guessing six or seven different churches, I mean. In a community of about 3,000 to 5,000 people.
Dale, you've mentioned a few times in talking to us about that Duncan was successful in wiping out the culture, but overall it was a good thing. And I guess that makes me wonder why it was a good thing.
Well, I didn't know. I should have explained that further. It propelled the Tsimshian people because of that into the modern, and it put us closer to being even with the people that were at the time in the present modern culture.
Now, as far as expectations.
But it was detrimental to the native culture or the Tsimshian, because now they're leaving behind their culture to become part of the modern culture, or as I always said among the natives, the white man culture. So I give it that name, modern, because it belongs to everybody. He was a Spanish person in Yupik, you know, in Athabasca. We have to take our part and contribute to it, because that's the way the United States is made out of, with all these different kind of people. And all of them have been contributors to the advancement of the modern culture. They're a part of it now. But the native people was pushed out of it. They could have been a part of it, but since they were pushed out of it, kept out of it for a lot of years, basically at the bottom of the food chain, and look at it that way. And we were kept there for a long time, so we never really were allowed to participate in the moral culture in the normal sense. So we're recovering at a slower rate than, say, the black people or the Spanish people. But the Tsimshians had a head start of the remainder of the Native people.
And that's owed to Father Duncan.
Yeah. So we're having to look back, our generation, our parents' generation, have to try to go back. And we did have people go over to Canada to try to learn what the culture was back on their side, that stayed back. You know, the people that stayed back and trying to recover that part and incorporate it in our new little cattle here in Alaska. And it's coming back real well. You can look at it too, is that, you know, since our culture is wiped out, we appreciate it more than, you know, because of that.
Any last questions?
I was sort of interested in, you mentioned that every morning you would watch your father as he was building.
Mm-hmm.
Did he ask you to help him at some point? Or?
He was always deep in thought, because I don't know why that was that way. I never talked to him very much. I just observed. I was an observer, but I paid attention to him. He told me to do something, I did it. You know, and it was that kind of like a respect that I had toward my dad. You know, even though, in a normal sense, I never really had a father-son relationship with him. You know, buddy, pal, he never, you know, when I played basketball, he wasn't there, you know, because he was always busy. I mean, he was trying to make a living. And just, and I guess I was trying to be about, you know, near him or around him every time he did something. The only time I really had an opportunity to do that is when we were working on boats. Mm-hmm. Or the boat, our boat. He'd show us and then kind of a teacher-student relationship. That's about what it's now. But, you know, I appreciate it. I mean, I learned a lot. I would, you know, if you want to quantify it in percentages, I would say he had an effect on 90-95% of the way I turned out.
I was sort of curious, when you were observing him, either building the boat or repairing it, would he say things like this?
He never talked that much. He wasn't a very talkative person. But he'd talk enough to say, oh, this is the way he's doing. And he'll show or demonstrate, you know.
Would he let you try?
Yeah. That was always the end of his offense. No, he did. And then he'd come around, let me check on it. And when you see you progress to the point of getting your self-sufficient and self-reliant, and you'll go somewhere else and work on something else. You just have to take care of it. And when a new thing come along, you know, I first started to start off, and I built, you know, learned about nets. That was the first event, I think, as I recall. And then on the house, it was an ongoing project that never got done. As with many guys, you know, when a guy is a professional, it's professional at something. You know, and in this case, my dad was a professional boat builder and carpenter. You'll do beautiful work. You'll do work like this on projects, you know. But if you look at his house, you go, see? And how come your house don't look like this? You know, the guilt. And it was always in an unfinished state. But you look at a lot of professionals. I had a father-in-law who was an electrician. The same way with him. Because they're trying to help somebody else, you know, with their acquired knowledge.
And then I was sort of curious about your experience at the high school in SJ. Did you spend a whole 9 months there, or were you able to go?
Yeah, I returned home every summer.
So you never went home for the holidays?
No. It's when you lived right down on the campus.
And how big of a campus was it?
They had probably 200 students. From all over.
All over.
Yeah, we had guys from Pope and a lot of interior Fairbanks, a lot of southeast villages, Hanan, Sipley, Novatello, Touchdown, Athena. The other thing with us, you know what, when I was going there, I had to pay for that school. Probably. What I earned in fishing. like Mount Edgemont was free to the students, I went to that. And that's where I wanted to go, because all my friends were there, and my cousins and whatever, and my buddies with me. Like the one that lived with us is my first cousin of mine, he's him and I are about the same age, and he went there. And since he lived with us, Dad was saying, you're going to go to Sheldon Jackson, both you and his name, my cousin was George. And George didn't want to go. I didn't either, because he didn't want to go. But I couldn't say no to my dad. But he could. In fact, what he did, when he gave us both applications for Sheldon Jackson, my cousin hid his away in front of him and said, wait, go to an hospital for a while. He didn't tell him, he didn't tell my dad, but I had to fill mine out first. So initially, when I went to SJ, it was under protest. And I wouldn't say that to my dad, but it's something I had in the family. But then once I was there, maybe a couple of weeks, or a couple of months, and made friends and developed a life. And then the following year, I went back voluntarily. Every year after that.
So what years were you there?
52 to 56.
And how much did you pay for?
It was a lot of money back then, but it was $260 a year plus books.
And so what kind of courses?
I took all the required English. I took a lot of science type subjects and math courses, all that they had to offer. And algebra, and geometry, and physics, and biology.
So how would you travel from
by plane and or boat? We didn't have a ferries back then. So when we graduated, my dad came up on my graduation on his fishing boat and took home all those people that would come up the cabin. He put bunks in the hats and put all the girls up in the bow. It was about 30 of us, I guess. And we turned back and sit down on the boat. Boy, it was rough. And we turned back and the girls were up in the bow where the bow was going up and down like that. I mean, you don't feel it much back in the hats. Those girls up in front of us got seasick.
And then, so how long
of
a boat trip was it?
27 hours.
Wow.
And I had to clean that all up. I almost got sick there. We up in the pilot house, we had a stairway that went down like this, from the pilot house down to the galley, down to the forecastle, and down to the engine room. And when we got to the forecastle where the girls were, you get so used to where the switches are, and just came around in the dark. I turned it on and looked at it, and turned out and my arm back, because they were kicking all the way down.
There was no traditional medicine for seasickness?
Where?
Did you know of any traditional medicines for seasickness?
There was a lot of nuts. You know, they'd say, eat crackers. You know, it was just something that evolved, I guess. Dry crackers, saltines, powdered bread. But no, it didn't work. Because I got, you know, early on in my fishing career, I never got sick until I was probably 12 years old. And then I started, you know, feeling sick after that, season after that. And what really brought it on was when we went to diesel engines, that smell, the diesel smoke and oil, that's what really kicked it off. And I finally got over it when I was 16. We were heading across the Gulf. And I was sick in the dark because we were going out and down a big swell. I mean, they're big. And both were completely destroyed. We're running out. Three of us running together. We'd go down one trough and they'd be up in one and then go down. Just completely disappear while we come up in the other side. You know, we're maybe even eighth of a mile of each other. But you look at those boats disappear. I mean, great big swells, you know, 30 feet high. Sea running on top of it. We couldn't force it to get. And it takes about 3 days to run across the Gulf from southeast over to Kodiak. And while we were running across, one of our boats and the thing broke down. We had it towed all the way to it's on the bottom end of the Copper River. In the middle of the Gulf. And way out in the middle heading towards Kodiak, we had to take a ride on a train. It goes down. He's going down to Seattle on a marine raider to order the parts for that, boat to repair it. And stopped. And we told him to fly it up. And we needed him. He got there before us. It took us a couple of days to get him. And we were on the middle of it. And the whole fleet went in there and stayed there for 3 days. Got that boat running again and took off. But, you know, we fished a whole month out of False Pass out on the Mission Chain. I was 16 then. That was during that trip that I told you about when my dad and met with somebody that he knew as a young child living there in Hoonah. Did I tell you that?
I think so.
Yeah. And they recognized each other a lot and wrote there and water and we ended up spending, we didn't get back to the boat 2:30 in the morning. We were being all, that's when I found out I was half drinking.
Curious to know, like when you were a teenager, you had mentioned before about playing basketball. So I'm wondering, you know, a lot of games are universal, like what kids do when they're young. Like today, there's a lot of video games and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, what kind of games did you play? What kind of fun things did you do?
That dominated my high school career. Basketball did. I played it. In the summertime. And I was the only freshman to ever make the high school team. At that time on that, in that school. Because they never used to let freshmen in. But apparently they both had the ability to compete with those guys. I didn't play that much as a freshman, but I was on the team. So I was on the team for 4 years when I was there. And I was the only guy that ever had a four stripes. Stripes every year on the team.
How about with your brothers and sisters at home? Do you play card games or anything like that?
Kick the can? No. Basketball was the thing, all everything, was everything.
Even when you were younger?
Yeah, in grade school. We started off early. Yeah. Now, that was something funny. When I came up here, hockey was just on the rise in the high school and grade school. And I was here, we were here when they built the Big Dipper. That used to be an old hangar. I don't know if you guys knew this, but they transported that hangar all the way from near Toke, the village area. By the name of Hez Ray spearheaded that and moved the whole superstructure up here. You know, it was an old military wood constructed hangar that was used during the Second World War. And we moved it up here, and that's what we played hockey in for a long time. There's nothing, no walls or nothing, but right out in the middle of it. I cut out 20 below. Mm-hmm. And got in cold and then postponed practice and our games. But all our games were outside, and all my kids were brought up in that. I asked him one time, I said, you know, I played basketball all my life. He said, how would you like to start something different in this family? And try hockey for a year. You like it, stay with it. That's what happened. Life stayed with it. So I never had a chance, you know, to grow up with them and participate in their sport other than carting them around, you know, make sure they attended all their practices and things. Up here, that was a daunting task because I was working 12 hours a day. A lot of our practices were like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. We had all these different ice rinks all over the, you know, different high school, grade school. So we had practice in one place, game in another one, you know, stuff like that. Traveling. So I'd get out of work, and my wife would meet me out there and bring my lunch for me. And bring enough lunch for all the kids that eat, and eat on the way, and while they're at their practice, stay there. And I'd have to take off for work because I'd be work at 6 o'clock in the morning. For 2 or 3 hours, on the track. And then, you know, it became a way of life. It seemed daunting at the time, but it didn't look at it. It was a lot of, but it made our family close. And at the time, I didn't realize it, but that's the way we are now. And even after they're all grown, they have their own kids, and we get together and have all these memories. I took a lot of dinners like you're doing here. Back then, it was film, you know, the movie film. No sound. I took a lot of that and I converted a lot of that to video. And what I did is, I just lucky, I had them one time attending the transferring of from tape to video, and moving film to video. And they were sitting in there. And so the sound of their remembering, they're talking among themselves, right? And they're remembering all that. So that became the narration for that own movie. So I've got documented on that. And then Peter kind of that way, discussing and laughing about, you know, remembering this, remembering like a lot of video of their hockey game. My daughter, she was a brownie, and covered a lot of it. And I said, I've got a lot of memories of their growing up on it.
So back to your teen years, when you'd go home for the summer, would you have contact with your grandparents?
Yeah, they died when I was in high school. Maybe in the middle of my high school career.
And before that, when you went home for the summer, before they passed away, what kinds of activities?
A lot of the women back home then were, they had the, not clubs, they were members of the church clubs. And they would put on feeds or would support city function, and participate in that. And grandparents and my parents would all, most of the women, participate in this. And you'd always have to go to them if they were on a babysitter, I guess. And any lieutenant models that they were growing up. And I enjoyed it, because I had a lot of friends because other kids were there. Like a social gathering, both the adult and the adult. And they do their thing, we do our thing. Most of it's kind of around.
And
when you were talking about your stepdaddies, I was asking myself if they ask you a lot of questions about this
mission
culture?
Some of them know more than I do about it right now.
Really? Yeah,
in fact, my oldest boy lives there in Mother Catherine, so he was there during the recovery portion of the culture. And he generation of people to recover and shed a lot of the shame of our culture. It wasn't for them, that was a start. I don't feel bad about it anymore. I don't feel the shame. I said it's still something like that. It's just that it's 60-70% walked away. But I'd like to say my generation, my dad's, they harbored all this. And it had a profound effect on the inner relationship between sons and daughters and parents. Religion as a whole is very strict. We live by this rule, spare the rod, spare the child. We live it. So our parents were that way, our grandparents were that way. We did something wrong, but you got to live it. And you're disciplined in one. And this is the way it was all going on with them. So, and again, I look at it as a good thing because I compare today the way the younger generations are, you know, they're lacking discipline. Whether it's parental or self-discipline, a lot of it's been lost. In my personal opinion, I think it triggers a lot of social type problems that we have today.
One last quick question. You don't have it. I was sort of curious, and you might want to, you know, think about answering it at a later time. Was I know I've been to a lot of different types of conferences, and then there was a group of people saying that the reason that our Alaska Native people don't have these parental qualities is because they were sent away to boarding school. And do you think going to SJ affected how you were as a parent, or is that?
I think it affected me as a parent in a positive way. You know that I received a lot more strict discipline than say I applied to my family. Discipline that I went through was kind of watered down because I didn't believe like the church did about that type of discipline. So you might say because if it wasn't for them, I would not have applied the discipline the way I did. I was trying to perfect the discipline I received when I applied for marriage.
And that was both in the home and at the school?
Right.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions before we finish? So we've gone through your childhood, teenage years, and then the next class session, and I think Janice will be leading the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go to the next phase, which will be young adult. And we could sort of start to reflect back on the glorious young adult.
I can talk about it right now.
Who wants to get the videotape for the next class session?
I haven't done anything yet.
So, Denise.